Accession number 312, Miss Farnborough, Reel 15.
In some cases there were even gardens there, and they would be growing flowers or a few vegetables, obviously thinking that they would remain there long enough to reap the crops that they had planted. And there were some which had even little bookcases with books in. I think I mentioned in my book that in one officer's dugout I found an English grammar. He was probably studying English in his free time. It was rather a good idea, though he was on the Russian front. He might have been transferred later to the English front if he'd known English well enough.
Apart from that, were the trenches constructed in a different way?
Yes, they were wider, they were deeper, and many of our Russian trenches were very poor. They were little better than ditches. Some of them so shallow that they would scarcely come above a man's knees. Well, you can understand that would be a dreadful thing for a Russian soldier to take refuge in such a shallow trench. Nearly all of them had, when there was time, the wire entanglements in front of them. But the Austrians were especially cautious. They sometimes had lines of five or six lines of entanglements, then a wide open space, and beyond that another five and six lines, and beyond that another at a certain distance. So they believed greatly in taking every precaution. And the trenches themselves were rather wonderful. They were mostly stacked up, bolstered up by wooden stakes.
This is the Austrian trenches.
The Austrian trenches, yes. Our trenches, as you know, I think you may have seen some of the photographs, those in sand in the wood were bolstered up with boards, because in sand, you will understand, it would fall in at every moment, every action of the spade. But the rock trenches that the Russians prepared for their advance were dreadful, and the soldiers feared them, because any shell falling into rock, the rock itself would disintegrate, and disintegrating would kill hundreds of people. They were dreadful, those rock trenches, and they must have taken hours and weeks to dig.
Why do you think the Russian trenches were inferior to the Austrian ones? Had the men not had the proper training and leadership, or was there a misunderstanding of the purpose?
No, it is difficult to say, but we never found the Russian trenches on an equal with the Austrian trenches. And I believe on the Western Front, some of the German trenches were really wonderfully designed for every comfort. I don't know why, whether the Russians thought it was waste of time, whether the engineers were not thoroughly versed in what was necessary. But then you must remember, the Russian front was so enormous. They were fighting from the Baltic Sea right down to the Black Sea and to the Mediterranean, right down to Romania. Because the Romanians, though they were our allies, and though they were very faithful, wonderful men, they were poorly equipped for any long-term warfare. The Austrians, too, were not sufficiently sufficient warriors to please the Germans. The Germans, with their ruthless, extraordinary ruthless education in warfare, they would try and oust the Austrians whenever they could, push them into the background so that they, the Germans, would show them how to fight when it was necessary. And the Russian soldiers always feared, more than any Austrian, the German soldier in the trenches. And when they knew that they were bringing up new manpower and long-distant missiles, there was a tremendous feeling of nervousness among our soldiers, because they knew that any offensive on the part of the Germans must be terribly devastating. And of course, it was the German offensive that started the great retreat in 1915 in Gorlitz, where we were stationed. For nights and days, countless nights and days, they just showered the Russian trenches, leveled them with the ground. There was no question of staying there. The Germans were forced to retreat. And all around, they were closing in. And then, of course, began the great retreat of 1915. 5.5 months they retreated until the winter came in the guise of a friend, an ally.
Did the trenches zigzag?
Yes, I have even photographs where you can see in the distance some of the Austrian trenches taken at a great distance. And you could see that cut on the hill, perhaps the soil was rather chalky, and you would see the little white thin line zigzagging in places over the hill. And in other places I took a photograph of them, and while I was taking a photograph of them, some of the shells fell very near, and I managed to get a photograph of a shell exploding between their lines and our lines. So I still got that one, that photograph. It isn't very clear, but it is enough to see that a shell has exploded and that there are lines drawn about the hill which are not normal, which were, of course, the Austrian front lines.
Did the Russian trenches zigzag as well?
Not so often. Not it depended on the geographical position, as you will understand. In mountains, of course, it was very, very difficult. The Carpathian Mountains, where we were fighting principally for the most part in 1915, 16 and 17. Though in 17, towards the end, we went down into Romania. But we went straight into East Galicia, where the lower spurs of the Carpathians were. And beautiful they were, the Carpathian Mountains, very beautiful. Some with very, very high peaks, some wooded, some stony. One behind the other, they ranged these glorious mountains, and there, here and there, would stand up in an enormous peak. Those, of course, were left to themselves. The soldiers didn't attempt to climb them. The valleys were their goal, because the mountains in themselves would shelter them. The difficulty was when they were overtaking the Austrian army, and the Austrian army, really, the armies were retreating in a demoralized condition, then it was difficult for our soldiers to climb the hills that had been vacated, and knowing that the higher they climbed, the easier it would be for the enemy to distinguish them with a bullet or a shell. But it was done many a time, and many a time they tried to seize the trenches on the top of the hill, which were still inhabited by the Austrian soldiers, and to climb up those hills under full fire of the enemy was a ghastly experience for our men. In many cases they did it. It's incredible, really, what one can do in time of warfare. I don't know, you ask me if we, the sisters, were frightened. I would ask, are the soldiers ever frightened? If you know some of the almost miraculous things they did, our Russian soldiers. And that is why I shall always believe all heroism is seen in warfare. But such kind of heroism that the Russians showed in their lack of equipment, lack of food rations, miserable, watertight ditches, and still they fought.
I think you said you found his suit of body armor in a trench.
Never heard of it. That's why I couldn't understand that word armor. No, they had the ordinary uniform that any bullet, any knife, any spear, any pointed object could go through at once. Not even the officers or anyone had anything that could protect them. I think that didn't belong to the early 20th century. It might have been in the Second World War. I doubt it, even so, because when you go to war, you don't go protected.
Did any of the soldiers ever have any little superstitious things to protect them? You know, if you carry a rabbit's foot or a crucifix or something?
No, their only superstitious item, if you can call it that, and it wasn't, it was their religious icon. That they would carry. Each would carry a little icon, usually hung round the neck at the last moment by their wife, their mother, or someone in the family. If the wife were there, it would be she. If he was not married, it would be the old mother. And always they did that. And always them, for them, the icon was given with tears and with prayers. And they came to regard it as really something almost magical which would protect them at all times. And there were many instances where the soldiers, when wounded, when dying, prayed to have the icon that they could touch and hold.
You presumably had rather different religious background than they had had. Did you have any difficulty dealing with their spiritual problems?
No, none whatsoever. I don't think there was any difference. We both believed in God. In many cases, perhaps they, more truly, more deeply than I. Because you never really believe in God until you come up against great danger. And I have known people who, despite the fact that they had been taught by religious parents, have belittled the idea that God had any strength or any knowledge of his life or any could give any protection to it. But in time of danger, I've seen those men praying. Probably for the first time in their lives they would pray. Danger is the most extraordinary thing. I think in some cases it brings out the best in man. In some cases, it brings out the worst. Do you know that old saying? Courage and cowardice are undoubtedly contagious. And I'm sure it does. I'm sure those two are contagious. If you are among a crowd and they're all panic-stricken, automatically, no matter what you're longing to do or what you're wishing to be, you are panic-stricken too. If you are among people who are steadily plodding on, doing noble work, helping where it is necessary, courageous, quite forgetful of one's physical self, then I think you too become part of them and you work together as though you are really immune from any danger.
I should think the appalling conditions of battle would make you lose faith in God rather than reinforce your faith. How can such a thing happen?
Well, it was very interesting. I'm afraid this has been cut out of my book, that I was travelling once to Russia to Moscow from the front. I was on vacation, and I met in the train an old batushka, a chaplain who had been in one of the Red Cross units near us and attached to the same division. He had known our men. He had seen and heard of our Red Cross unit. So immediately we became friends, and it was very interesting to ask him about people whom he had known and I had met.